and long-term mentor, Pat McClure. I just am overwhelmed that we're here again together. And Pat is a dear friend to many of us and an integral part of Word in Life. In addition to her many innovative contributions to the community, as well as to the world of art and education, her human curriculum has been an award-winning body of work that truly aligns with this soul work of waking up to the sacred inner relationship of all things, of every species and life forms, race and nation. I serendipitously met Pat over 45 years ago when I moved to Santa Barbara and have had the joy of working and learning alongside of her all these years. Over our joint venture of Community Human Intelligence Program was an innovative program bringing intelligent non-dual solutions to the rampant problems inherent in two-sided thinking. I must say she's been the guiding light for my spiritual journey, and I'm sure for many of you as well. I can't think of anyone better suited for unpacking this beautiful chapter about Alexander John Scott, who saw the golden thread woven through all things. Pat can certainly speak to how we can be part of the reweaving of this fabric of life through accessing the power of imagination, the faculty of knowing, of remembering that spirit and manner are interwoven, a bridge into the future and new ways of seeing and living. This soul work has never been more needed than now in this time of upheaval and brokenness. This Celtic wisdom of the inner relationship of all life in the service of love is most beautifully described by Rumi's familiar words. Out beyond ideas of wrongdoing and rightdoing, there is a field. I'll meet you there. When the soul lies down in that grass, the world is too full to talk about. Ideas, language, even the phrase of each other doesn't make any sense. And now I'd like to lead us into listening to Pat's words of wisdom with the prayer that's offered in this beautiful chapter. And as you hear these words, listen deeply within the sacredness of your own being. Awake, O my soul, awake to the sacred dreams that are stirring within you. Awake to the imaginations of the heart and the cherished hopes of what is yet to be. Do not be afraid. Awake, O my soul, to the sacred dreams that are stirring within you. Awake, O my soul, awake. And now I'd like to turn our morning over to Christine, who will sing us in and bless Pat.
Bless you as you share your gifts of spirit, life, and insight. We welcome you with joy.
Oh, Christine, I get what other speakers have said. That blessing is felt even up here in Sacramento. And oh, Marianne, thanks for that beautiful introduction. Well, you all can see how much fun we've been having working in the fields together for a long time. She's an extraordinary and inspiring friend. Well, last week we learned how Celtic Christianity's sense of the sacredness of life was celebrated in song and word, the Carmina Gadelica. Our trio of speakers gave us a chance to experience the Celtic love of life in a kind of idiom that belongs to today. We heard Gaelic words of praise in a video showing us sunrise on our own seashore, walking along beside a burbling creek, listening to chanted Gaelic words of praise as we tramped through the woods. And then we were drawn into the ancient call and response way of learning that celebrate the life and presence of God. In the days since, I found myself humming, "The way knows the way," as an affirmation of presence along my own path. Today, we're diving into chapter 5, Sacred Imagination and the Life of Alexander John Scott. In these pages, we fast forward the golden worldview of Celtic Christianity to 1,200 years later. In the early 1800s, that positive view of humanity as part of the sacred hoop of the world was an anathema to the Calvinist view that humankind was defiled, born in sin and prone to evil. But any normal self-preserving man might soften his tune, shade his candle, and find a way to compromise with the self-righteous establishment for whom he worked. But for Alexander John Scott, the knowledge that humankind emerged out of what Matt Fox calls an original blessing wasn't just an idea or a strong argument. It was laid down in him like platelets of calcium laid down the bones of his body. Through an inner knowing that our author calls sacred imagination, he knew that God was present in every bit of creation, not the tribal vision of God in all nature, which is pantheism, but a panentheism, God in the world, God's light shining through all things like a thread of gold. Remove that thread and the whole fabric of creation falls apart. It was a vision of truth at the heart of the thing. This gained not by calculation or study, but by a deeply felt sense whose authority completely outweighed the church's insistence on the sinfulness of the species. So Alexander John Scott stood up for his certainties through the terrible trial for heresy and heard every voice against him, including his father's. He was defrocked and thrown out with every door in the world closed to him, and it nearly killed him. It broke his health. When he recovered, he left his Calvinistic kin and turned south to find more of his kind in London. It was his capacity for the great ideas, the sacred imagination, that nearly undid him. Yet it turned out to form a new path and to ultimately gather a group of groundbreaking thinkers around him into a circle that began to change the way the world thought. The group that was drawn around him included Thomas Carlyle, the great philosopher, John Ruskin, who was the voice of the arts for the empire, Charles Dickens, William Thackeray, Lady Byron, and when he was in town, Frederick Chopin. Two particular friends were Charles Darwin and George MacDonald. Darwin was promulgating his theory of the creation or the evolution of species. And I quote his niece, who said that Scott was, quote, the first to reflect this dawning truth, even now only just above the horizon, end quote. Sacred imagination was at work in both their minds, allowing them to perceive the unfolded scaffolding of the real world. Now let's unpack what I think Newell might mean by sacred imagination. Let's start with the word itself. Its etymology gives us the heart of the word. The linguistic root of imagine is imago, a term for the larvae of an insect. Within that egg lies the potential form of a mature insect. Say it's a dragonfly. The tiny imago contains its entire wingspread, its glistening scales, its agile body that will eventually emerge from the larvae and an egg. The entire insect is there, but in protoform, just waiting to be expressed. That's a good working definition of imagination, intuiting the unseen whole by a glimpse of its part. A leap of imagination turns out to be an accurate phrase. It's a gift that belongs to all of us, and it's meant to be developed into strength throughout childhood in order to serve the sterner needs of the adult mind managing the adult world. Think back to the great ramblings and imaginings of your own childhood. Let's call that wonderful natural capacity imagination in lowercase letters. It's a capacity that needs special nurturing in the world of today's children. Sacred imagination is an even bigger gift. We might call it imagination in capital letters, uppercase letters. It is, as John Philip Newell writes, a faculty of deeper knowing. It taps into the creative process of the cosmos itself. Today's science, with its new technologies that measure the subtle energies and frequencies of our mind, our brain and body, have found that those frequencies form fields of information within and outside our physical bodies. We're wading through fields of information without even knowing it. Our bodies are pulsing with energy. Each beat of the heart sends out a 5-watt wave of energy that carries information and forms a matrix of energy fields around the body. They're shaped like an apple, like a torus, and form 3 energy fields ranging from 3 feet clear out to 15 feet around the body. So we can't see these information fields, but they play a role in the automatic functioning of our bodies to stay healthy and alive. They play a role in the functioning of our intelligence and consciousness as well. Now, other kinds of energy fields we know about. Light waves we know about. We see from red through the whole spectrum to violet, but the infrared and the infraviolet ranges are invisible to our eyes. Sound waves we know about, but can physically only hear a limited range of frequencies. For example, we can't hear the sound signal that our own planet makes. But the Earth turns out to have a heartbeat with a resonance of around 7.83 hertz. Since all planets operate as energy, I assume that each one might have its own heartbeat sound. And I like to think of some future astronaut drifting through space, listening to the signature sounds of the planets, the way we listen to the songs of the whales droning in our own great ocean spaces. Now that's lowercase imagination. The invisible fields of energy and information that we know about makes it less of a leap to consider fields of energy and consciousness that the Sufi tradition has long called the imaginal realm. Cynthia Bourgeold has recently written a compelling book entitled The Eye of the Heart that brings the dynamics and power of the imaginal realm into working range for spiritual seekers. She writes that the imaginal realm is a meeting ground, a place of active exchange between 2 bandwidths of reality. That is how its cosmic purpose is fulfilled and the way it can be most fruitfully understood. Sacred or deep imagination takes us into the space between our reality and the higher realms for glimpses of what might be coming our way. We actually live in the 8th day of creation. God's creative process didn't stop with sunset on the 7th day. Creation continues. Alexander Scott and Charles Darwin and Teilhard de Chardin all glimpsed this deep tendency of evolution and development in our reality toward a coming of something more over and over. Einstein's imagination gave him a ride on a beam of light into the imaginal realm, which led him to formulate the equation E equals mc squared, proving that matter is made of energy. Another great mind in Scott's London circle was the Reverend George MacDonald, a young clergyman who became one of Scott's devoted students and followers. He too found himself convinced of the deep truths of Scott's vision and was similarly tried and defrocked by the Calvinists. In fact, he found refuge in Scott's household while he wrote his first attempts at fairy tales. They all carried strands of Scott's spiritual and moral outlook, and they were wonderfully readable. He became the J.K. Rowling of his day with a tremendous opus of fairy tales. As an example, Newell gives us a quick précis of MacDonald's Princess Irene, our heroine, who faces challenge and danger from the underground goblins seeking to overturn the enlightened kingdom above and to capture its princess. As the goblins are completing their plans, the princess decides to explore a winding staircase, forgotten and dust-covered, up to a turret room at the very top, where she finds a beautiful old woman spinning a golden thread that she explains has woven through all things in the princess's world. Should the princess ever find herself in danger, all she needed to do was simply feel for the thread with her finger and follow it wherever it led. She might find herself in strange and frightening places, but in the end, the golden thread would lead her back to safety. And sure enough, the goblins break through. The princess follows the thread and its feel out into the countryside to a strange cottage where she is welcomed and sheltered. The goblins' plan turns back on them through some miscalculation, and they are killed by their own scheme of destruction. I read many of those fairy tales, as did my children. Colorful, stylized drama, and always bound by some reconciling goodness. MacDonald had a strong influence on the next generation of writers. J.R.R. Tolkien and C.S. Lewis both acknowledged their debt to him. I read aloud most of the Narnia Chronicles to my children when they were younger, and we all loved Aslan and the golden thread of spiritual presence that Lewis wound through those grand adventures. I also read Tolkien's great trilogy aloud to my girls and nephews on long camping trips over 3 summers in their late childhood and early teens. The landscapes and challenges of The Lord of the Rings seemed a perfect match for our camping and trekking in the natural world, and our imaginations, lowercase and uppercase, were sizzling in the evenings around the campfire. Each author created an entire and believable universe that was threaded through and through with that golden filament of moral force and spiritual presence. It's what elevates those story cycles to the status of powerful modern day myth. Joseph Campbell is another figure whose consciousness seems to have been touched by encounters with the imaginal realms. His seminal work decoded the myths that are the archetypes of human striving and experience. And he made it easy for us moderns to recognize those patterns at work in our own lives. He acknowledged the myth keeping of Tolkien and Lewis and MacDonald. And he in turn was able to pass along that golden thread of deep moral spiritual presence in storytelling to George Lucas in Marin Valley through long walks and talks. Lucas attributed much of the power of his cinematic myth-making in the Star Wars series to the understanding that Campbell transmitted to him. My own children were theologically formed by those fairy tales and myths dressed up in 20th century clothing. And my daughter, Megan, used parts of the Star Wars series, the parts that employed the Force, as a teaching strategy, illuminating the power of spiritual presence with her teen groups in her parishes. Reflecting on all this, I can't resist telling the now famous words of Einstein when he answered the question of an ambitious young mother who wanted advice from him on how to prepare her child to become a scientist. Einstein said, well, first, give him fairy tales. Second, give him fairy tales. And third, give him more fairy tales. The oral tradition, the telling of stories, the singing of truisms around the evening campfire has imprinted our human expectations in ways that continue in our own time. Child psychology explains that children's language and thinking skills are most strongly developed by listening to stories read aloud to them throughout their childhood. The word is spoken, and the child's mind responds by creating a living image of the action and the plot, while the meaning is picked up by their heart. The advent of radio carried on another version of the oral tradition in my girlhood. There were certain stories and comedies that we would listen to weekly. When television was in its early stages, an interviewer asked a little girl how she liked the stories that she could watch on the screen of the television box. Her answer was that she liked the pictures better when she listened to the radio. While sacred imagination isn't seen much in the stories of our commercialized entertainment today, I find myself surprised to be able to report that I find it cropping up in the very institution that pilloried Scott and MacDonald, the church. Evolution occurs culturally as well as biologically, and we are surely seeing an evolutionary change within the institutionalized church. Historically, the church's teaching has been about God, about Jesus, about the light of Christ, about doctrine and creed. But there's a growing hunger today for a direct experience of the divine. Prayer has been the personal pathway to the divine, but much of our prayer experience has involved an inner stream of talking to God. Since the 1960s, other forms of prayer have begun to emerge in our own culture, often drawn from traditions in the East. They all make a deliberate use of our consciousness to step beyond the root brain chatter of our minds so that we can listen to the stream of silence that holds a depth of presence unreachable by any other means. The most basic practices are mindfulness and meditation. This kind of deep listening is generative. Its processes of perceiving and sensing can be put into an action that just keeps developing as we use them. All this smacks of the living presence of the Holy Spirit to me. If the imaginal realms carry patterns of God's process of creation, I think that spiritual practice often taps into that stream. Let me tell you the story of one church that took a trial run at adopting a spiritual practice and how it brought a sacred listening and imagination effort into personal everyday reality for the folks who were involved. The year was 1997, and All Saints by the Sea, an Episcopal church in New York City, All Saints by the Sea, an Episcopal church in Montecito, skipped a line, got a packet of papers from Trinity on Wall Street, a church in New York City. It was sponsoring a nationwide pilot project in deep listening to the Holy Spirit using a Quaker-based practice of silence and focused listening. All Saints was to be one of three churches in Southern California to be part of the project. The busy rector looked at it, threw it in the wastebasket, from which it was rescued by an alert church secretary who had already read it with some excitement. She prevailed, and the invitation was accepted. The project's name was Listening Hearts, after the book by the same name, which became the Bible for the project. This was my parish, and I became one of the project leaders with no clue that it was going to change my life. Our mission was to learn how to sit in small groups and listen to whatever was being offered, a passage of scripture, a wisdom story, some poetry, a current news story. Then next we were to become silent inside our minds and listen for the voice of response that arose within us. With that prompt, we would share the thought aloud with the group. The goal was to note the difference between our own personal voice, filled with its opinions and knowings, and the voice of the Spirit, quiet and deep within us. It was the most challenging thing any of us had ever done. About 2 years along, we discovered the work of the Heart Math Institute and applied what we learned about the intelligence of the heart to our process in the Listening Heart Project. It turned the tide for us. We learned how to use breath, conscious intent, a positive feeling tone, and inner silence to actually shift our inner biochemistry. It shifted us out of the daily running state of the sympathetic nervous system with its normal anxiousness and defensiveness into the calm and open parasympathetic system and its feelings of safety and accessibility. That shift caused the heart's rate to become steady and even, with its energetic frequencies in steady, even balance. We discover that when the heart is in that steady state, its frequencies naturally entrain the brain's frequencies, and the two functions come into sync or into phase, and a much higher kind of functioning follows. Tim, I wonder if you could please put up that wave chart for me.
You got it. Here we go.
Nope. Yes, thanks. The little graph is intended to show you what is coming into phase between heart and brain. I couldn't find an actual phase comparison graph of brain and heart, but I wanted you to have an idea of how the two systems work together. So just ignore the wording and simply look at the energy patterns. The middle and lower graphs show the brain and heart each going about their own business, keeping us alive and kicking. Sometimes those systems are opposed and other times working just at different rates, but they're fulfilling their original agendas. However, the top graph shows them in alignment, in a new agenda together. When heart and brain match up, they become coherent, and the prefrontal lobes of the brain come alive and available in a whole new way, able to operate empathically, telepathically, precognitively, and holistically. There may be some potential for frequencies that function out of space and time. But this remarkable coming into sync doesn't happen on its own. It requires conscious intention and practice to bring these two systems of intelligence into phase or alignment. It's called heart and brain coherence. And when we shift into the coherent state, we experience and understand the world differently. One recent finding suggests that this is the state of flow that artists, musicians, and athletes find when their abilities peak in momentary alignment. We may have seen that state in some of this winter's Olympic athletes. Thanks, Tim. Well, it took our group 4 years to bypass our conditioned responses and thinking to reach a rough collective version of the chart's in-phase diagram. We reached a pretty steady level of quiet, deep listening that produced an authentic feeling response as our standard and fairly frequent blockbuster insights. What surprised us most was that when the fresh, authentic new response emerged from us, it always carried a strong bodily tone with it. That became our marker. If it was a felt response, it could be trusted as an authentic piece of information arising from a place of truth within us. We'd established a spiritual operating system that had become stable for us personally and as a group. That was 25 years ago. And that group, plus many new members over the years, is still in operational ministry. Our spiritual practices have been amazingly generative. We would pray for what we should be about, listen deeply, and imagine together, and find an amazing consensus of agreement. Over the years, the group adopted the practice of centering prayer that still meets 2 to 3 times a week. And now we know the critical importance of silence to our lives. So we have a rough competence in becoming still and opening to those deeper realms. The next ministry that we sensed needed to be developed was a serious reading and discernment group around books that were spiritually promising, many of them Cynthia Bourgeois' books. We called it a Wisdom Way group. It's on hiatus now, but we're still reading. The final ministry that emerged from the listening and sacred imagining of the group was based on our frequent encounters with healing presence. That ministry still runs today in our partner churches, All Saints and Trinity Church downtown in Santa Barbara. Our sessions used all the spiritual practices that we've learned, how to listen deeply and hear what isn't being said, how to hold the healing desire in steady, simple clarity, and to use sacred imagination to see things whole again. Then how to drop into deep stillness and coherence together and hold it all in a long receptive silence that allows the spirit to do the work of pulling things into working wholeness again. The way knows the way. And at the conclusion, both seekers are somehow more whole. It's an act of faith and sacred imagination, if ever there was one. I believe that the Listening Hearts group, with its faithful and purposeful pursuit of listening for the voice within and learning how to discern a deeply truthful personal response to things, stumbled onto the edge of the state of consciousness that Alexander John Scott experienced and that made him so adamant about the absolute truth of his vision of a God-infused reality. I suspect it's the state that the great mystics report back from, the state that Jesus modeled and that the disciples often achieved in their extraordinary work of teaching and healing. This kind of aligned in-phase consciousness seems to be wired into us physically, but it's largely unused. Just waiting until we've established and stabilized all of our physical and cultural systems of survival. There looks to be another human agenda waiting in the wings that spiritual pioneers have glimpsed and gloried in. In the labs of NIMH, the National Institute of Mental Health, Dr. Paul McLean nicknamed the unused prefrontal regions of the brain the angel brain. It possesses huge systems of neural circuitries just waiting to be myelinated, fired up by use. The deep craft of sacred imagination is surely one of its potentials. In closing, I'd like to share a personal story of inadvertently dipping in and out of an aligned state of consciousness, knowing nothing of what I've just been reporting, but a way of seeing and thinking that allowed me to glimpse the shape of something coming just below the horizon. So it's 1960, and I'm in the frenzied latter part of my master's degree studies at Stanford up in Palo Alto. It's an interdisciplinary degree combining art, psychology, and educational theory. Each field as rigorous as the next. Art, rigorous? Oh, you bet. My charge was to draw and paint as constantly as I could in and out of all the other studying and meeting and discussing I was doing until my visual work became a language that could speak visually. I'd been banging away with acrylics, watercolors, pens and pencils, gouache and pastels, doing lots of representational work. Some of my watercolors even sold. And some abstracts. I'd started a little drawing diary, hoping to get in a daily sketch or two to augment all the studio work. I have photos of only four, but they're the ones that tell the story. So I wonder if you could start the little cycle of photos, Tim. Photo one, please. It's winter, turning into springtime, and my sketching is getting more and more basic, mostly lines of the thing and how they cross and shape what it is. I think this might have been a dandelion. Photo two, please. Peach trees are coming into bloom, but all that interests me is the lattice and network formed by its branches and twigs and the temporary blossoms that they make possible. Photo three, please. Reflecting on a visit to one of San Francisco's Gothic churches, I imagined it on paper as mostly a network of stained glass and concrete ribs. Photo four, please. One of my most basic organic webbed forms here that was repeated over and over in dozens of drawings and as the underpinning of some small paintings. Well, they're all gone now, but you get the drift. I was drawing with my outer eye what my inner eye was leading me to see, the underpinnings of the visual realities I was encountering. Easter was coming, and I wanted to test this new language on something of great importance to me. So I attempted two biggish mixed media paintings about 3 feet square each. They were about death and resurrection, both painted at speed with Shostakovich symphonies blaring, everything else forgotten, including meals, wholly concentrating on the meaning that was emerging out of what I was painting. Photo five, please. The first one emerged as death. Icy lights shearing away from the networks and wormholes of death that looked and felt bottomless, the harrowing of hell. Photo six, please. The second one simply bursts from my brushes, arcs and arches of life and light, shaped light, fractured prismatic light, space filled with joy, resurrection. Thanks, Tim. Remember now, this work was happening in Palo Alto in the early 1960s. 20 years later, in that same neighborhood, 20 years earlier in that same neighborhood, Hewlett and Packard were working in Bill Hewlett's garage, designing one of the first computer systems. That garage is now a California state landmark. 15 years after those paintings, in another nearby neighborhood, Steve Jobs and Wozniak were starting another electronic enterprise from their garage. And 20 years after that, in the same neighborhood, Larry Page and Sergey Brin were starting Google from their basement. Palo Alto was the nest out of which the Silicon Valley had been hatching under my artist's feet. It must have been in the air I breathed, though I knew nothing about it. It was in the early 90s that the penny finally dropped. The World Wide Web had just been formed. And as I read about it, I realized that in my student painting days, my consciousness had picked up on the fields of information and invention that was foaming invisibly from Cupertino to Redwood City. For those intense, single-minded months, I seemed to have slipped into a coherent state. It guided my imagination to express a visual design of what was coming next in the wider world, the World Wide Web, www.html language. So, sacred imagination. It fueled the life of Alexander John Scott and George MacDonald. And though we might have used a different terminology, it played a role in Darwin's massive insight about evolution. I've traced his designs threading through the writings of Tolkien, Lewis, and Campbell, and from there to the Star Wars movies of George Lucas. The sacred imagination of the Celt seems to be a strong element in today's hunger for a direct experience of God. And the state of consciousness that produces a felt connection to the divine can now be learned and practiced in a number of ways by anybody in any church. You've read how the practice of listening with the heart, which is the core of sacred imagination, led to 25 years of spiritual discovery and growth within one parish church. You've learned that today's neuroscience explains a kind of biology of transcendence when we learn how to bring the brains in our hearts and head together in coherence. And finally, I shared my own story of a painter's sacred imagination that intuited the rising of the World Wide Web 30 years before it was announced. In closing, let me share a shortcut that approaches sacred imagination and the state of consciousness that's heart coherent. Slow down. Put on the lenses of wonder and awe and look at our world through them. See the world around you with your heart, with a sensing of your body's response, as well as your mind's eye. Deliberately take a daily wonder stroll and see the familiar as if for the first time. Deep silence, listening, breathing, feeling into reality with your body. All of these are the gateway to wonder. And as Socrates said, wonder is the beginning of wisdom. Thanks.
Thanks so much, Pat. Would you like to read our questions that invite us into our breakout rooms today? They're in the chat too, if you need
them. Yes. They're both about imagination. Lowercase imagination is personal and ordinary, and uppercase imagination, which is sacred imagination and the imaginal realms. So question number one is about the lowercase imagination. Think about your own imagination. How do you use it in your life? And question number two is uppercase imagination. Think about sacred imagination as an ability to tune into the cosmic process of creation. What insights have arisen for you this morning? So we have plenty of time for a good breakout and then plenty of time to mull it over. I hope that you'll bring me lots of questions so that we can think forward into all of this together after our breakout groups. I'll see you in a few minutes.